Okay, the meeting will come to order. The first item on the agenda is the minutes of the February 28th meeting. Representative Lilly moves the minutes. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Now we're going to take testimony from people on this, and we'll go by the list as they signed in on the whole issue of foreclosures, which all bills tonight are on. Jim Wilkinson, I saw you someplace. There you are. Oh, okay. You might want to testify something on the... You've been involved a lot on the discrimination issue. Maybe Representative Cole.
Very, very briefly describe for members of the committee who maybe didn't participate and for those in the audience the process, the interim process.
Oh.
Just very briefly. I don't think you should spend a lot of time on it because I'd like to get into the bills and
okay.
Get out as quickly as we can. But there was a lot of work that was done on this over the interim.
Yes. And thank you, Representative Coles, and you were one of the ones that did a lot of work on this over the interim. What happened was after session was over, I assembled a lot of the people that had an interest in foreclosure, everywhere from Acorn and Legal Aid, law professors, the realtors, the banks, the landlords, tenants, Legal Aid Society, many groups like that, and then we tried to pick, as you know, a total nonpartisan leadership, and so we had each subgroup had one Republican, one Democrat senator, and one House and Republican and one House senator. And so we worked on this very nonpartisan group working together and formed a consensus afterwards that we think will have a great effect on foreclosures in Minnesota. In fact, I'm getting calls from all over the country for our bills now that we're rolling them out because we had the leading bills last year on it in Minnesota. Congress even adopted ours, and now a lot of the states are calling to find out what we're doing because of our leadership on that. So, and Representative Coles mentioned all of the incredible work that was put in. We had coordinators who are here to answer questions. And I just think everybody, I see some members that were part of those working groups, and everybody deserves recognition that was part of that group. So I think that's pretty much the explanation, and there's a number of bills came out of that, and we're hearing most of them tonight on that. So thank you, Representative Pauls, for that. The first person then we would, and we want to take some testimony, is Daniel Winderman, lives on Newton. Could you come up to the, could you come up to the podium to give the testimony? You really got the wrong information. You live on Newton, right, a couple blocks from here.
That is right near here. It makes floods constantly.
That's a city issue, and so it's not a legislative issue on that. So,
is there another room in this building where I should be?
You could be at the Falwell Neighborhood Group, which is meeting in the what used to be the hockey room down the hall.
Or I don't know where that is. I know that I live in the neighborhood, and I came to this place to discuss this.
Okay, sir, we're not
going
to...
So please don't dismiss me like I'm stupid.
No, I'm not... Sir, I don't think that you're stupid at all. I think that you got probably into the wrong room, and I think the Falwell Neighborhood is meeting right down the hall. If she'll escort you over there.
That's funny, because when I walked in the door... She asked, are you here for the meeting? And I said, yes. And I am here for a B meeting. So if you would walk me down the hall, I would appreciate that.
Yes. Well, Jeff Strand is the next one on the list.
Is there anyone else here for that other meeting?
Yeah. Is anybody else here for the Falwell Neighborhood meeting? Oh, it's meeting tomorrow night? Okay. Deb will tell them. Has anybody come in now since we announced it that wants to testify? I think you want to testify, don't you? Do you want to come up and sign? Oh, there's another list. Okay. Mr. Strand, do you want to state your name for the record?
Jeffrey Strand. I live at 5100 Thomas Avenue North. Chair Mullery and representatives, I want to be brief. I just want to reiterate the importance of additional resources for foreclosure prevention, outreach, and neighborhood response and remediation. As you know, there were 5,668 foreclosures in Hennepin County last year and 2,895 in the city of Minneapolis. I urge you to look at the report entitled Preserving Home Ownership in North Minneapolis, Responding to the Impact of Foreclosures. And I think the analogy to the tsunami is applicable in this case. While I don't want to diminish the 35W bridge collapse, literally thousands of families in Minneapolis are being destroyed. I appreciate your coming to our neighborhood.
Thank you, Mr. Strand. And Mr. Strand was the chair of one of our large neighborhood groups for many years in this district. Patricia Tucson? Oh, there she is. Would you state your name for the record?
Yes, I'm Patricia Tucson. I live at 2015 Russell Avenue North. And right now I'm going through foreclosure. About a year ago, my mortgage was $800. And from $800 to now, it's $1,600. And my interest rate is 11%. And it put me in a position that when a predator came by and said, well, I can help you, I went to it. You know, I broke to it, and that put me in a worse position than I am now. And that's about it. I feel like a dummy for being, you know, going to a predator. But that interest rate and the amount after you pay mortgage, you can hardly get the stuff, the things that need to be done for your house. You can't get anything fixed. You can't hardly buy anything for a single woman. You know, up to my age, I'm 65 years old, believe it or not. and it's, you know, it's hard. And that's about all I have to say, you know. Any help, please, you know. If I had any help, I would love it. You know, thank you.
I have a question. Did you say you went... The payments went from 800 something to 1600?
800. I was paying 800. My interest rate was more than that.
Was what?
My interest rate went up. And now it's 11%, almost 12.
And
like they told me, they said.
What was it before?
It was about 9 to 10 a while back. And then they said in about. Now it's going up again. You know,
it's going up again.
Going up every 3 months. It was 13. It was 1,300 at 11%. And now, you know, over 11, it's 12. It was 1,300, and then it's 1,600. And they're not through. And you know, I had to do something.
So you're paying $1,600 now. Your payments are scheduled to be $1,600 now, and they were $800.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes. Okay. Wow.
Thank you, Robert Johnson. Robert, state your full name.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And address.
My name is Robert Johnson. I live on 3435 James Avenue North. 6 months ago, I initiated an organization, grassroots, called the Northside Homeowners Association. So all of us homeowners that live in the community of North Minneapolis can maybe band together and discuss a lot of the issues that are affecting our community. Primarily, it's livability. It's crime. It is the foreclosure issue. It's poverty. It's disparity. And we want to work together and try to come to some solutions. I moved here 12 years ago and started my family, and we had, at that particular time, I suppose about 10 families on our block. We had lots of kids. It was a great community to live in. It was very stable. Crime was low. Unfortunately, the predatory lending that started happening after the dot-com boom of 2000 totally started to impact our communities. I could see it. I could see these houses starting to come out on the market. More and more rentals were coming into the community, more and more subsidized housing, consequently more and more crime. And if any of you would like to review data that we've compiled between a comparison between rental property and crime in the city of Minneapolis, I'd be glad to share it. Joe has some of that data. I'm concerned about what's going to happen next. After this foreclosure tsunami, which is the way it was described, has impacted our communities. We that live here, we that have to deal with the 5 boarded up homes that are on my block that we have been shoveling snow for, that we've been watching out for on the streets to make sure no one's breaking in. Through all of these issues, I strongly urge the legislature to consider legislation that curbs rental property, that controls rental property in the future for us as a livability issue. In a lot of ways, a lot of this foreclosure stuff is past us. I realize that we probably have a couple more years before it's all said and done. And regrettably, a lot of people have been victimized from this predatory lending. A lot of people that were flipping homes, with T.J. Wacconi on our block, who owned 3, have increased our property values, or allegedly increased our property values, by $150,000. We're paying property taxes on property nowhere near what we could get the value of our home. How is this going to be addressed with the city and the county and the state? What is our value of our property really, really worth after all of this? And how are you going to work with the county and the state and the city to actually, you know, come to a realistic value for properties? I personally don't think that we're going to see a turnaround in the market until everyone really knows what houses are worth. And through this whole crisis, what I've seen is, you know, a lot of people that are interested in shopping, but they're walking around going, well, when's the bottom going to hit? And how can you, as the state, come to aid perhaps getting that worked through? Again, you know, I would urge legislation beyond just the foreclosure issue, working towards building stable communities. This is I look at this as a glass half full opportunity for North Minneapolis and a lot of the communities that are impacted by this foreclosure crisis to really look at how we can turn around communities of poverty and disparity and make them stronger and stable communities. I didn't really have anything prepared, but that's all I got. Thanks.
Thank you. For those that don't know, Robert Johnson has done an incredible amount of work on the problems in this neighborhood and has huge numbers of statistics for us. And he's got no staff to do it like most neighborhood groups. He's done it on his own. The next testifier will be Tracy White. Mr. White, would you...
My name is Tracy White. I live up on 1312 Upton Avenue North, and I see you this weekend. And I'm up for the Deferred Act about giving homeowners a little bit more time to work it out with some of the lenders to extend time for them to maybe get back on their feet. For instance, my cousin, her mortgage has gone up $1,800 within the last year. And she's in the middle of working with Acorn, which I work with Acorn and the Northside Urban League. And if not able to modify, she might need to pick up another job, but she's going to need more time because within 6 months, they're ready to come take her home. The programs do work if we can get more people to help us out. We just need time. I mean, my story is out. My unemployment just ran out. Luckily, I got my interest rate dropped from 10.95 to 5.7, but as of today, I have no income coming in, but I have put some money away. So I prepare myself, but there's not a lot of people out there like me that don't know these things, and they may need help on getting a little bit more time to prolong, you know, for a year to help, you know, maybe to get another job or whatnot, to give it time to so they can get caught up on their payments. And like this person back here said about all the empty houses, I have 4 empty houses on my block too here, and it gets worse as we come north this way in Minneapolis. And the scary thing is what's going to happen this summer? And my biggest fear, what's going to happen to my neighborhood when the summer comes and we have all these boarded houses up? And it took me a year and a half to clean so where the kids can come out and play because of criminal element that comes around from boarded up houses, you know. That's another thing that I was on the agenda might work. But the biggest thing is to give people a little bit more time to defer that, to allow the people, if they can pay part of their payments, you know, and throughout the year and try to get caught up. And like I said, I go out and take notes, and there's just way too many empty houses, and there's people just need more help and a little bit more time to get these things done. So that was my biggest concern. And thanks to ACORN and the Northside Urban League to get me the knowledge on how to help out has really been a big help. And I think more people need to be notified of these different organizations if they can to get this help and have you guys help them out to keep it so we can all stop this thing here because we know it's nationwide. So that's all I have to say.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Hoyt. Keani Robinson? You can move the mic down a little.
Hello, my name is Hello. Keon Robinson. I'm a single mother of 10, and I'm here because I have an adjustable arm. I've been through ACORN, I've been to Urban League, and I still haven't got a job. My mortgage is scheduled to adjust again in May. And I will be facing foreclosure because I don't have enough income. I called FHSA, I called everybody, and they're going by your credit and by your income. And they said my income, I don't make enough, and my credit, my score ain't perfect. So, I mean, I'm wondering, where is the help? You know, the things that they're talking about is still not designed to help everybody. It's only criterion out certain people. You know, it says you need this much credit score, that you need this much income. It's not a solution. You know, we need some kind of solution that will help people with bad credit to help keep their houses instead of facing them out on the street. So that's what I have to say.
What did your payment start out initially at?
My payment started out at 14. My payment is at 18 now. It adjusted twice, and it's going to be adjusted for the third time in May.
Do you know what the prognosis is for that?
No, they did not tell me.
Okay.
But I mean, I'm living on limited income. I'm only paying my mortgage payment every month. I'm not paying my bills or anything. And, you know, I'm getting shut-off notice from my bills, so I don't know what to do.
Shut off from the utilities?
Yes. You know, I'm only making my mortgage payment, so me and my kids can have somewhere to lay our heads. You know, I said I'll deal with the utility company when it comes, but I ain't been able to do anything but pay my mortgage.
Okay. Did anybody have any questions of any of the witnesses so far? Oh, okay. Jay, did you want to testify at all on that, or do you want to wait till the bill comes up? Wait till the bill comes up. Is there anybody else that wanted to testify on this? Okay. Then what we'll do is go to the first bill on the calendar. Representative Gunther. And Okay. Representative Hellstrom, Representative moves Representative Gunther's bill to pass and be referred to local government, her committee. And for everyone here from the neighborhood, you should all thank Representative Gunther for helping with the Lowry redevelopment. He was his chair in the committee and that recommended that. So when I was carrying that bill, he was helpful to me on getting the funding for that. So thank you, Representative Gunther, and you're back in the neighborhood. You helped.
Back right next to the cemetery. My wife's relatives are buried in, too. But anyway, it's House File 3428. It's a real simple bill, but it's a very important bill. This bill allows tenants to pay their utility bills if a landlord doesn't pay. So if it's your heat bill, you won't freeze. If your electric bill, you'll be able to cook if you go and take your landlord's place and pay the bill. You then can subtract that payment from your rent. So that's basically a simple way of putting it, but it's very necessary and very important to those people that have landlords that don't do the right thing. And I'd love to answer any questions you have.
Representative Lash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Conkley, is there a provision relating to when one service takes multiple units?
Representative Gunther.
Yeah, thank you. Good question. If less than five units, they can take over the whole bill. If it's more than five units, they can take it over for their own unit.
Mr. Elwood, do you want to help Representative Gunther?
Mr. Chairman of the committee, Ron Elwood with Legal Aid, Representative Lesh, the answer to your question was if it's a single service, could you repeat the question?
Yes, if you have, for example, single gas service for a multiple unit dwelling, and I live in one of them and I want to be able to pay my portion of the gas but not all my neighbors, how do I do that?
Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Chair and Representative Lesh, it would depend on in whose name the bill is in. So if the bill happens to be in the individual tenant's name, then it's just regular, like any other utility bill, so this law wouldn't apply. But if it's in the landlord's name, and the landlord doesn't pay the bill, and it was in a 1-to-4 unit building, what this bill does is provide two options for the tenants. The first is they could all get together, pool their money, pay the utility company for the most current bill, the last month, no arrears. It's very clear. They're not going to be paying the landlord's arrears. It's just the last month's bill. In that case, they get one more billing period during which time the folks can figure out what to do next. They could also, at that time, or at the end of the next month, or at the beginning of next month, I mean, one tenant can take over the account and say, I am now the account holder. And there would be no down payment, there would be no requirements, just like any brand new customer moving into the neighborhood, moving into the service territory, you take over the account. And going forward, the service remains on so long as the tenants pay the rent. Now, if one tenant is the account holder, the other tenants are permitted to contribute to that total bill, send in the receipt, and deduct it from there. Does that answer your question?
Representative Lash?
I think it does, yes. That the bill has to be paid in full. You can't just avoid partial shut off by making partial payment. I think that's answered. But I do have a follow-up question, Mr.
Representative Lash.
And that is, why would the utility company, prior to this being enacted, ever object to anyone paying into that account in the first place?
Mr. Elwood.
Do that right now?
Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh, the pay and deduct opportunity does exist under current law, except it hasn't been very easily utilized by the tenants, and the utility companies have a concern about who's the account holder. It's very difficult oftentimes for them to figure out
had to do is that it was a voluntary option on the part of the utilities. The tenants could come forward, but the utilities were not obligated to do it. This agreement, the bill you have before you, is an agreement among the landlords, all the utility companies in Minnesota, and all the tenants, consumer advocates, to increase options for tenants and improve the payments to the utilities. So it's kind of a win-win-win situation.
Representative Bingham.
Mr. Elwood, I think you kind of touched on this, but maybe just to clarify or expand. So how does that, like, let's say the landlord decided to retake over for some, take over the payments again, or because there's a switch of tenants, or for whatever reason, the landlord picks up the bill again. Can you maybe elaborate a little bit more on that?
Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bingham, thank you for asking this question. There was one other aspect of the bill that's important. If the landlord does become current on all the arrears, under the new statutory language, the landlord would have the absolute right then to retake over the, or take over the account, retake the account back over, and reestablish the account. And then thank you for saying that.
Mr. Elwood, you didn't realize his legal capacities.
I didn't. I'm not surprised, however, having looked at that. Does that answer your question?
One follow-up.
Representative Bingham.
Our tenancy, again, I think the answer is that they submit stuff, but am I correct that in order to be, if they were reimbursed or whatever, they have to submit the documents, and would the landlord be able to reimburse them?
Mr. Elwood.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair and Representative Bingham, the way it works is the tenants receive some documentation from the utility that the bill was paid, and then submits that in lieu of rent, and then that payment is automatically deducted from the rent.
Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Representative Ducker, I imagine that if you address in the bill on line 2.11, that paragraph says single meter residential buildings, and I think this goes to Representative Lush's question, right, is that familiarity with the building code reminds me that generally you don't have more than a few accounts on one meter, but there have to be some unit or some buildings where you do have still 10, 12, 14, 16 units on one meter just from much older buildings and older service being added. I mean, is it rare enough so that we needn't really address that issue of, let's say, I'm the only one, everybody on this committee has a unit in our building, and it's $782, and I just pay $782 just to get my gas keep it going so I can cook. It is very rare.
Mr. Elwood?
Situations, are anything we can do to resolve that issue, or is it covered or not?
Mr. Elwood?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kingley, actually I think it's covered because, again, there are actually two options for tenants. The first one is to pool their money and pay the bill. And that under current law is clarified here. It's clarified in that they don't have to pay any arrears, just the last month's bill. So in your scenario, that would be covered.
Okay.
But if it's in order for somebody to take over the account, that option is limited to 1 to 4 family buildings. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it's just not feasible beyond the smaller units.
Thank you.
You are right. It's getting more rare all the time because you have more than one tenant. They always look at the other one saying, he's using a lot more than I am. Mm-hmm. I expect it to let you see. And that's been a contention before the legislature for a long time.
You see how different Representative Holbert's bill is than mine. You know, she's very energy conscious, and I just waste all the time.
Are there any other questions or any discussion of the bill? Okay, all in favor of Representative Gunther's bill and it be re-referred to Representative Hillstrom's local government committee, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Next one, Representative Hillstrom's bill. Representative Hillstrom. Representative Hillstrom moves her own bill, 3474. Go ahead and present. Representative Hillstrom moves her DE1 amendment to get it in the shape that the author wants. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Go ahead, Representative Hillstrom.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair members. This is an attempt to clear up the reduction in
Mr. Elwood's a professional witness tonight. Mr. Elwood?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, well, first of all, before I continue on here a lot all night, but I really just want to publicly thank Representative Mullery for the efforts that he put in to put all this stuff together. Everything you're going to hear tonight came out of the committee that he formed and he conceptualized and he ran. And I think what you're all doing tonight is really moving the ball significantly forward for homeowners and tenants in what you're trying to do to address the foreclosure crisis. And I just want to publicly thank Representative Mullery for his work.
And not represented. I don't want to do it. I won't demean you that way. But I think everybody should know Mr. Elwood put probably 1,000 hours at least in on this very heavy work. So go ahead with your answer.
This is simply to facilitate the process of using the 5-week redemption period. It is an option in current law, but by adding this language to the statute, it does provide some certainty for lenders so that they can invoke the period. And if there are more detailed technical questions, we do have Kevin Dunleavy from the Real Property Section of BARB also work on this, which can answer more detailed questions.
Representative Holberg?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we're on 3, 4, 7, 4, 5, 6.
The delete all.
Okay.
The DE1 delete all.
All right. It referenced the process, the service of process and compliance of Subdivision 6. However, we don't have Subdivision 6, so can you tell me what the process is in Subdivision 6?
Mr. Elwood?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, I'm going to defer to
Mr. Dunleavy. Mr. Dunleavy, do you want to explain that you're the representative from the Bar Association of the Property Section? State your name.
Mr. Chair, my name is Kevin Dunleavy, and I co-chair the Legislative Committee of the Real Property Section of the State Bar Association. So, and you may know Chuck Parsons, who was the previous chair, who came and testified at the legislature.
And the previous chair to him was Jim Nielsen, who wrote most of the language tonight.
And I consider both of those my mentor. In answer to your question, Representative Holder, the summons to complaint has to be served like it has to be served like a summons to complaint in civil action. That means service to process, personal service, if possible. The problem is that in a lot of situations, if the property is abandoned, it's impossible to actually hand the summons to complaint to the owner of the property. So in those cases, then the service by publication.
Representative Holbrook.
Mr. Chair, so when you say service by publication, is there any preliminary step where you have to, like, certify mail and keep the forwarding address? Or, I mean, I'm assuming that most of these are bad actors at this point, so maybe you want to phone, but if in fact you have somebody that had gone to their parents' house or whatever, and frustration, I mean, if you can't find them personally because they're no longer on the property, then you just arbitrarily print it in some paper, which nobody's probably going to see. Is there any mail or certified mail or any need to check to see if there was a forwarding address left with the Postal Service? Or
Mr. Dunleavy?
Chairman Mullery and Representative Holberg, there's a requirement for an affidavit. Unfortunately, I don't have the statute in front of me, but the affidavit that has to be filed with the court, it's going to be, if I remember, the elements are, it's like the house is boarded, the window, the front door is broken open, windows are broken, the power is shut off. Those types of elements have to be shown to the court. In addition to the service process, the court can actually influence decision based on service process. The way publication works, there's a case from that I know from law school called International Shoe.
Mr. Dunleavy, we have members of the committee that are in law school right now, so they know how well they've been.
Anyway, the Supreme Court says publication is good enough when you're dealing with an interest in real estate. The rules of civil procedure require the attorney to try to make a good faith effort to serve the summons complaint individually before they publish. And that affidavit has to be filed in court before publication.
Is that all? Representative Emmer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Dunleavy, Mr. Elwood said earlier that the 5-week period is provided somewhere already in law. Isn't the standard redemption period is 180 days? Is that what it is?
6 months. Mr. Dunleavy?
Mr. Chair, we're
or 90.
The standard redemption period is 1 year.
1 year.
And that was changed probably back in the 30s to create a 6-month redemption period if the creditor gave up the right of deficiency judgments. Then probably about 10 years ago, the legislature decided to add this 5-week redemption period with the judicial process. So we had to go to court, we had to try to serve them, we had to show these elements of abandonment. And the public policy that the court was addressing at that time was a concern about crack houses, that houses, you know, abandoned houses would become a public nuisance. I don't know if that's an issue today, but it's the same public policy. The state has what's called police powers and has the right to make these kinds of laws in order to protect the public welfare so that an abandoned house doesn't become like a rat-infested house or that would affect public health or attractive to criminals. So that's the reason for the 5-week initiative.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Emmer.
Well, then I still have my question because it seems like we're making it easier for the lenders to expedite the process. And frankly, that would concern me if the legislature put the 5-week period in with specific criteria, hopefully protections for the homeowner, so they don't have car trouble and miss a hearing. I'm concerned. What you're doing is making it so easy to the point where you've got somebody who might be honestly trying to get there or they've been missed and you've expedited it to the point where they might miss, what are these, usually they're not even an hour hearing. I would imagine they're 15 minutes that are allotted. And if you're not there and the judge goes ahead and enters the order, you're done. It just makes me a little nervous. Expediting it and then just sort of failure to appear at the hearing.
Mr. Dunley.
Representative Emmer, the specific problem that this legislation is intended to address is that in some counties, the judges are very reluctant. They're making their own public policy decision that property ownership is more important than the legislative exercise of police powers to get these properties under control. Essentially, what this does is tell the judges the legislature wants the properties to be under control of somebody so that they don't become a public nuisance. If somebody's on their way to the hearing and the car breaks down, there's a real civil procedure where there's what's called excusable neglect. And so after a judgment would be entered, they still have the 5-week redemption period after the judgment, but they could go in and they could prove up, and I think most judges in Minnesota, most of the judges I know, would say, okay, your car broke down, you're not, this property really isn't abandoned, okay, we're gonna vacate that order. That's probably what would happen.
Mr. Chair.
Just 1 second, I have to make an announcement. There's a green truck license BA430 that's in the U-turn, and they're blocking in the bus for the youth that are trying to leave, so somebody... After that, nobody in here apparently. Okay. I'm sorry, Representative Emmer.
Thank you. All I was going to add, Mr. Dunleavy, this makes me very concerned. I understand the police powers versus the property owner, but I'm going to favor the property owner, especially when you're talking about 5 weeks. The problem I have is I'm familiar with the excusable neglect. You get up to 1 year to come back in, but that's money to people who already might have trouble paying. And I think it just adds another level of cost onto it. I can appreciate the lenders and the neighborhood's interest, but it seems that the five-week accelerated process is already there under certain criteria. It just makes me concerned that making a failure to appear wins the day.
Oh, other comments on this? Representative Kalin, sorry.
Mr. Chair, as much as I don't want to admit it, I agree with Representative Emmer.
Well, I changed my opinion then.
Who's going to use it against whose campaign here?
I think Representative Emmer made a point in forever now. But I think that I wonder if we're not creating a situation where I'm going to throw out a possibility where there's maybe a lot of 100 cases where Representative Emmer is discussing may create an unintended consequence. If we were to give the judge discretion rather than the failure to appear being conclusive evidence, negative, either prima facie evidence or probable presumption of abandonment. I'm wondering if Representative Emmer would feel that satisfies his concern, or what your thoughts might be for creating some other unintended consequence.
Mr. Dunleavy, or are you asking Representative Emmer?
Actually, what Representative Kalin will learn is I've been told by several judges in the state that 10% of the law actually comes out of the books, and the other 90% are already judicial discretion, so that would make me nervous.
Well, Representative Emmer, at one point when I was chairing a public safety committee, and the chief judge in Hennepin County came in front of it and gave an explanation of what his view was of the law as opposed to judicial decisions. And afterwards, I said, what you're really saying then is that the legislature kind of makes suggestions to the courts as to what laws should be, and then the court decides and passes the laws. And he said, yeah, that's about it. So did you have a response, Mr. Dunleavy?
Mr. Chair, or members, I think my response would be that it's a practical reality. The way it works, the predator doesn't want to go to the expense of going to get you to do a private production.
Didn't you want to test?
That's an adding cost to the foreclosure process. So, and I know the foreclosure attorneys, probably six law firms do most of the foreclosure attorneys. And I know that they're not going to bring a 5-week redemption period action on behalf of their clients unless it really is a very high probability assumption that the property is abandoned. As far as judicial discretion, I generally am very much in favor of judicial discretion. But in this particular circumstance, I don't want to name judges because a private conversation, maybe I would, but I can say that in this particular case, in this particular circumstance, the problem is perhaps too much judicial discretion, and this would hopefully rein that in a little bit.
Okay, any other discussion before we vote on it? Okay. Representative Hillstrom renews her motion that it pass and go to the Representative Van Atkins has requested so that it go to the we just found that out, so it goes to the Commerce Committee for whatever reason. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no.
No.
Carries. Next bill will take Representative Peterson. Representative Coles moves Representative Peterson's bill 3478.
And there is an amendment.
Representative Peterson, did you say the A1 amendment?
A1.
Representative Peterson, Representative Coles moves the A1 amendment to get it in the shape the author wants. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Go ahead, Representative Peterson.
Thank you. And Mr. Ron Elwood is here in case we need him for reference. There he is. The bill started out basically to deal with eliminating the cap on punitive damages. And after we spent some time getting into the bill, we realized that they were there for a reason historically. So what the amendment does is it puts the cap under punitive damages at $25,000 on line 22, and it leaves the language that was formally stricken on page 2. So it's a very small change. We have buy-in from most groups that were impacted by this, a better word. Other questions, please?
My understanding, Representative Peterson, is the chamber is now okay with this language.
Yes, we have
the
municipalities and we have the business community on board, and it's my understanding that the Senate will be amending their bill to conform.
To conform to yours. Mr. Elwood, did you want any, or you're just here for questions? Representative Coles. Mr. Elwood, and I don't know, I see Mr. Wilkinson creeping up from your office also. So,
Mr. Chair, thankfully Mr. Wilkinson is creeping up, but I do want to address Representative Cole's question. Okay. So, Mr. Chairman, Representative Cole, I'm going to answer the first part of it and then turn it over to my colleague. If you look at all the statutes in Minnesota where punitive damages are allowed, what you will find is that for the vast majority of them, there is no cap, and it is governed by Section 549.20, I believe.
21, I think. Or no, you're right, 20.
Which sets the standards for punitive damages, and as you, I'm sure you know, the standard for the award of punitive damages is extraordinarily high. Clear and convincing evidence of outrageous, egregious behavior. So it's not easy to get them in the first place. Most statutes that provide punitive damages don't have them. Things like, for example, when a beer wholesaler does something bad to a beer retailer, which, frankly, in my opinion, is nowhere near as egregious as the kind of behaviors that we're trying to deter under the Human Rights Act. There are a few statutes that do cap punitive damages, but they're of the ilk of where the landlord hasn't provided the security deposit on time or things like that. And I think there are other statutes where they are capped, where they're up at $300,000, et cetera, et cetera. So, but in deference to the concerns that were raised by the chamber and some of the other parties, we decided to move from $8,500, which, as you know, is just slightly over what one would can go into conciliation court for, which seems to be painfully low. They haven't been raised for 25 years and settle on an amount that was nowhere near what some of the higher caps are, but does significantly advance them. But to answer your specific question, I'm going to call on my colleague, Jay Wilkinson.
Mr. Wilkinson.
James Wilkinson, Legal Aid Society of Minneapolis, office at 125 West Broadway here in North Minneapolis. I'm not aware of any punitive damages awards in the housing real estate area under the Minnesota Human Rights Act. Frankly, they wouldn't make headlines at an $8,500 $8,500 level, and probably wouldn't be the basis for an appeal given the relatively low punishment that it seems to entail. Mr. Elwood's right, under the Federal Fair Housing Act, the limits are whatever the Constitution and the U.S. Supreme Court say are appropriate for punitive damages under Title VII, which is the employment discrimination area. It's $100,000, $300,000, depending on what size the employer might have in terms of its a number of employees, but it's an important statement, I think, as to what the importance of human rights are in the state of Minnesota.
Representative Coles.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know that I would necessarily disagree that it's an important statement. I guess I would ask why we're not putting that $25,000 cap into the cities. If it is for the subdivisions on page 2, we're leaving the 85. $500 gap there doesn't seem to me to be terribly consistent. And I guess the other question I would have, maybe if you can address that, Mr. Elwood, but also I'm not familiar with this area of law, specifically with the practice of this area of law, but we're talking about punitive damages awards being made by an administrative law judge. Typically, punitive damages awards are going to be made by a jury, or at least a party is going to have an opportunity to have a jury when there's a potential for punitive damages. They could waive their right to a jury. But we're talking about an administrative law judge here. So can you address that issue and whether that's a unique situation?
Mr. Elwood. Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Chair and Representative Coles, let me answer your first question, and let me put this whole thing in context a little bit. In the group that developed this proposal, when we looked at all, it was called the Remedies Group. We were looking for additional tools, both civil and criminal, to address the predatory lending issues where we took off from last year and some of the things that created the problems that we're facing today. And it was universally acknowledged that housing discrimination, just discrimination in general, was a factor. As we all know, it's very difficult to put your arms around the specificity. And so the consensus of the group was that it would be important to beef up the tools available to combat the behaviors that we're trying to deter. So that's just the broad context. As far as the cities are concerned, the rationale for restoring the old language simply is that the cities, through a variety of financial problems that they've been facing over the years and the lack of revenues that have been available, it was simply felt that this would be somewhat of an insulation at this point in time. That doesn't mean we can't revisit that later. To answer your second question, I'm going to ask.
Mr. Wilkinson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Coles, you're right. Typically, is either a state district court judge who will be handling a Minnesota Human Rights Act claim or an administrative law judge acting on behalf of the Department of Human Rights, and not a jury under the Human Rights Act. Although there are rumors that some lawyers think the Constitution may say otherwise, but that's the status where we are right now on this. It would be a decision made by an administrative law judge or a state district court judge.
Representative Coles.
Just very quickly, Mr. Chair, I guess my question was, how many other situations are there in Minnesota law where the right to punitive damages is decided by an administrative law judge without the defendant at least having the opportunity to have the issue decided by a jury?
Mr. Wilkinson.
I think this plaintiff's lawyers, such as myself, would say the same thing in the converse. How many, and I don't think there are very many instances where plaintiff or defendant don't get a chance to do that. Although under Minnesota 549.20, you do have to go through a judge before you get to a jury for any punitive damages in Minnesota. So the legislature has been pretty protective of defendants, I think, on the punitive damages field altogether. I think it would continue to be so with this proposed amendment.
Representative Emmer?
No, thank you. Either of the two witnesses, I understand you don't know how many punitive damages claims have been brought under this statute, but I'm interested to know how many claims have actually been brought under the Human Rights Act for discrimination in housing. For instance, how many were brought last year?
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, I don't think that the new consolidated court system gives us that answer yet in terms of being able to find out. I haven't actually done the research on it. We do have a representative. Now, I'm talking about state court cases where people can sue out their claims in state court without going to the Department of Human Rights. I think there may be a representative from the department here who may be able to address that, but I don't have that answer.
Well, yes, sir. Mr. Chair, I guess what I was looking for is this seems to be some group thinks it's a big problem, and I'm looking at this One, we don't know how many claims punitive damages were even an issue. I don't know how many claims have been brought. And two, as I'm reading this, you already get attorney's fees in addition to potential punitive damages and other damages, it looks like. So I'm wondering why we're going after the punitive damages phase of this. Where's the problem coming from?
Mr. Wilkinson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, I heard a rumor anyways that my preferred response, which would be to give the department and others more resources to dig into these cases, is not likely to happen in this session. So we do think that getting additional remedies out there would be a deterrent against future violations of the Human Rights Act, whether it's redlining in the future or reverse redlining, such as we believe has occurred here in North Minneapolis. So we think it's would be a deterrent to future violations, and I think an encouragement for other people to come forward and to bring cases if they feel they've been discriminated against in this field.
Mr. Elwood, were you going to? Okay. Representative Holbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Peterson, when you presented your bill initially, you said you thought you had most people on board with it. Who is opposing
it? Representative Peterson.
The municipalities and the counties were concerned about raising the cap over the 8,500. And the chamber and the business community are concerned because of the triple damages and the things that Mr. Emmer were talking about, that punitive damage being uncapped left the door wide open, but they all agreed that $25,000 was probably a reasonable sum given how long the $8,500 cap has been in existence.
Representative Holder.
Redlining or reverse
redlining? Mr. Wilkinson.
Redlining is the old problem where mortgage companies, banks, insurance brokers would draw a red line around certain areas and not write any policies in a certain area, oftentimes because of the perceived that this is a black neighborhood. Reverse redlining is what we believe we have seen in the last 5 years here, where there's a red line drawn around a certain neighborhood, and they have been inundated with predatory loan products, which is, I think the demand was there because of the first kind of redlining. The demand was filled, unfortunately, with the very bad products that are creating the kind of trouble that our neighbors talked about earlier today in their testimony. I'd be happy to talk to you about it further at any time. Thank you for the question.
Representative Pulver.
Thank you for that. I think that there should be hearing between the municipalities and maybe there can be some meeting in the minds by reducing the 25,000 and increasing the 8,500, but it just seems really unfair to have that big of a disparity for the same behavior. Especially, we heard about the troubles cities have been having. Mm-hmm. A lot of businesses have been having a lot of problems too, when they're already on the hook for three times the actual damages. This could get quite expensive, and what happens is when we start doing this, it just gets exasperated over the years, and pretty soon, 10 years from now, the $25,000 is going to be $50,000, and the cities are going to be sitting at $8,500 for no good justifiable reason for the same behavior.
That's where we were last week. I'm going to ask Mr. Carlson to come up here from the Inter-County Association. Did you want to speak to the municipality?
Well, one thing, Representative Holbert, in many instances we limit local government or the state's liability and have unlimited for other defendants. So here we're actually capping other defendants also.
Mr. Chair, I understand that, but when this bill was enacted, they were saying.
No, I really
don't. We're going to be saying, and now we're changing that. I don't agree with that. I certainly don't agree with a three-time jump, 8,500 to 25,000, and then they said 8,500, and that just moved it all, and everybody else.
Mr. Carlson, did you want to speak on it?
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm Keith Carlson. I'm the Executive Director of Minnesota Intercounty Association. There are two primary issues that affect local governments on this or any issue where we may be subject to legal claims. One is we're always the party with the deep pockets. So if it's a joint and several type situation, the other defendant may not be able to pay, but because we have taxpayer backing, the other party bringing the suit can always look to us to pay the ultimate award. And in part, that would be for the other defendant if we were facing a joint and several type situation. The second issue for us, and that's a more immediate one, is that most of us have insurance trusts, whether it be the cities, the counties, or the school districts. And all the policies are written with the current caps in mind. We have just suffered a relatively large increase in our tort liabilities that are being phased in right now from $300,000 to $500,000 on an individual incident. So all of our members are facing premium increases to deal with that. This would expose us to further increases, and also until those policies could be adjusted to take this into account, we would be have exposure for the individual members that would not be compensated by the existing insurance policies.
Representative Lesh, you didn't have it. Okay. Any other comments on the bill? Okay, Representative Coles renews his motion.
Mr. Chairman, I am going to move to amend $8,500 to $25,000 on line 2.2.
Okay, Representative Coles moves to amend. I assume.
I believe the stricken language was put back on the amendment.
Okay.
Mr.
Chair, Mr. Gehring, would you state the exact motion?
So the amendment would be to amend House File 3478 as amended by the A1 amendment. On page 2, line 2, strike 8,500 and insert 25,000.
Okay, does everybody understand the motion? Okay, all in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no.
No.
Carries.
Division.
Division? Okay. You won, but. Representative Holberg, that's the first time somebody's challenged my decision when you won. okay, then unless there's further discussion, Representative Coles renews his motion to pass it as amended to the floor. This one goes to the floor. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no?
No.
Carries.
Thank you.
Let's see. Thank you, Representative Peterson. The chair is going to lay over House File 3480. We are still working with the department regarding, I believe, fiscal note on that. Representative Coles. You're up. Representative Coles moves House File 3476. And do you have an amendment or anything?
I have two amendments, actually, Mr. Chair. And the page has the second one that if that could get distributed.
I do. Tell them to leave. Ask them if they have anybody else here.
Mr. Chair, both amendments would put the bill into the shape. I'd like to discuss it. Both have been agreed to by all parties. So, Mr. Chair, if we could, I guess I would take the A1 amendment first, which is technical language, changing the use of the word atonement to something that people other than real estate lawyers might be able to understand. So, Mr. Chair, that's the A1 amendment. I would move that.
Representative Coles moves the A1 amendment to get it in the shape, the bill in the shape he wants. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? No. You won by 2-0.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for your overwhelming support. Mr. Chair, members, the A2 amendment is an amendment that came to me this afternoon. This, too, would put the bill into the shape that I'd like to discuss it. It has been agreed to by all the parties, including the lenders and legal aid. So, Mr. Chair, I would move the A2 amendment.
Representative Coles moves the A2 amendment to get in the shape that the author wants. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Representative Coles, present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members. I served on the tenant committee, and one of the things that I was unaware of, and it was largely because I just had never thought of the issue, is that there are a lot of situations where tenants who have been paying their rent are getting caught up in the foreclosure problems that we're seeing today. Their landlord is not paying his or her mortgage or paying on their contract for deed, and we have tenants who are in a situation of kind of getting caught in the middle. What the bill does, it's fairly simple. It provides, the primary focus of the bill is that it provides some additional notice to tenants so that they understand the rights that they have during the foreclosure process. It limits the types of leases and the length of leases that that owners of residential property can enter into with tenants when the property has already gone into foreclosure, and provides some exceptions to that if the holder of the note says that they're willing to not boot the tenant out once the foreclosure goes through. They're willing to continue to allow the tenant to stay in the property. Mr. Chairman, there are some other fairly technical provisions I could go through in a little more detail. Mr. Elwood from Legal Aid, our professional witness this evening, worked on this issue with me, and I'm pleased to say that the bill has been, as far as I understand, agreed to by the lenders, by the banks, by Legal Aid. It really is intended to make sure that the tenants who are caught up in this foreclosure problem have a little more information so that they understand their rights during the process. So I'd stand for questions, Mr. Chair, and if they're difficult questions, I'll ask Mr. Elwood to answer.
Representative Coles, I think my understanding is the Multi-Housing Association also is in favor of it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I should have mentioned that the Multi-Housing Association did participate in these discussions, as you know, and they're in agreement with the bill as well.
That's what I thought. Representative Bigham?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Coles, I think you have a good bill here, and I like what you're doing, but I just had a quick question about if, for example, let's say you owned a building and it went into foreclosure, and I bought it from you. Can you explain a little bit about how that changes? That just maybe simple law that I don't know, but does that affect anything with the tenant?
Representative Coles.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bigham, I'm going to try, and then Mr. Elwood will correct me because I'm sure I'll make a mistake. If the property goes into foreclosure, Mr. Elwood, help me out here. If the property goes into foreclosure, we're going, and somebody agrees to purchase the property, and they have tenants that they're willing to leave in the building, this bill would not impact the ability of the tenants to stay in the building. Mr. Elwood, am I correct?
Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bigham and Representative Cole.
I'm taller.
You know, I just have to say that this is an unusual angle for the witness. I'm wondering if you're going to impose the podium requirement at the Capitol now on.
Mr. Elwood, all night I've been thinking of referring back to last year and a person that was connected to your office who we could not get to ever stop talking in our committee. And I'm thinking, we got to have a podium when she comes to our committee again.
I'll tell her that, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much.
No.
Representative Coles is right, and the situation is this. If you have entered into a lease, let's say I entered into a lease with you, and then you sold the building to Representative Coles, it was in foreclosure. I would have the right to remain on the lease until the end of the redemption period, and that's the heart of this bill. the heart of this bill. It gives tenants notice that they, when they need to leave. In one case, because of a court decision, tenants who currently lease during the redemption period, believe it or not, are not entitled to the notice to vacate. They can essentially be told by the lender, tomorrow you need to leave. Whereas other tenants will now get 2 months' notice. Everybody gets 2 months' notice.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions on this? Okay, Representative Coles renews his motion. And this one also was requested by Representative Atkins for some reason.
I can't wait to visit Chairman Atkins.
I think you may rethink that. Representative Coles renews his motion to pass as amended and re-refer it to the Commerce Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Gardner. Representative Lilly moves House File 3477. And do you have any amendments?
I do not at this time, okay. Mr. Chair.
Representative Gardner, go ahead and present your bill.
Thanks for having me, representatives, and Mr. Chair. I represent District 53A, which includes parts of North Oaks, Shoreview, Lionel Lakes, Blaine, as well as all of Lexington and Circle Pines. So I have some million-dollar houses in North Oaks, but I also have about 1,000 constituents who live in manufactured homes. And Lionel Lakes, Lexington, and Blaine. And in fact, the Paul Revere Park in Lexington is the only second manufactured home park to become a co-op. Today I've got Mr. Elwood here who can explain a little bit more about the bill that applies to manufactured home renters.
Mr. I think people may get the idea that I was correct when I said Mr. Elwood spent a lot of time on these bills, working on them over the last 8 months. Mr. Elwood, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Ron Elwood, Legal Aid. I also want to, before I speak to the bill, I also want to make sure we, again, thank Representative Coles for his activity on the renter committee. Really played an invaluable role and really appreciate the help. And also recognize the efforts of the Multi-Housing Association and the lenders, the realtors, and all the groups that work on that is before you today. And another group that deserves applause is the Manufactured Homeowners Association, with whom we are working on this bill. This bill does basically two things. It allows for additional time to reinstate when a manufactured home loan is in default. As you just heard Ms. Dunleavy explain, the procedure when you have a foreclosure on a mortgage, which can be anywhere between 6 months and a year's time. The period, conversely, for a manufactured homeowner to reinstate after a default is a mere 30 days. And so there seems to be an imbalance, and the first part of this bill would extend the time period to reinstate. The second section of the bill does for manufactured homeowners what we did for mortgagors last year, which was to install a strong set of predatory lending protections for manufactured park homeowners. While the basics, the concepts of the bill, we are in agreement with the owners. The owners were very gracious to work with us and recognize the need to do these two general things. There are a lot of T's to be crossed and I's to be dotted, and we have been working with them all very recently in the very recent past to get to the final global deal on this bill. So while we don't have an amendment for you today, what we are asking for you to do is to move this bill along in the process. I know it goes to Commerce, I believe.
Mr. Elwood, this one really does belong in Commerce. We can't figure out any reason why the other ones, which are strict real estate law, are going there, but this one definitely belongs there. So you're correct.
Well, Mr. Chair, like Representative Coles, we will be very anxious to visit with Representative Atkins, because when we do, we will have an amendment that is an agreement between the owners and the manufactured home park resident group and legal aid. So we would ask you to move the bill along and allow us the additional week. By the end of the week, we believe we'll be done, and we should be ready to go.
Mr. Elwood, it sounds like you're going to have an amendment on this anyhow. There's a technical amendment that we were requested to make, but if you're going to have an amendment, why don't we just send the bill as it is, and rather than worrying about technical amendments at this point?
Mr. Chair, it's your call.
I don't see any reason to do it now if you're going to have another amendment. It's just a correction of a 326 to 327. That can be done in the next committee, I think. Is there any... looks like this is a work in progress. So, and I did see somebody from the owners of the mobile home parks. This is agreeable with you to move it along to the next committee? Is that correct?
And Mr. Chairman, Mark Bruner, Manufactured Housing Association. Yes, we'll continue to work with Representative Gardner and Ron Elwood on sort of cleaning up some of the language, getting a little more focus. I mean, one of the reasons we have concerns is that it's really imposing on manufactured homes that are financed as chattel property, essentially the real estate model for foreclosures, which, you know, doesn't fit real well. So we're trying to work through some of the issues and keep in place some of the sort of the truths, if you will, on predatory lending. So we'll continue to work with Representative Gardner and the legal aid on the issue.
And you have no opposition to moving it on to the committee that
no.
normally deals with this?
No, we don't. We'll continue to try to get the disagreements resolved at that point.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Bruner. Representative Holder. I see Mr. Elwood nodding yes. Is that okay with Representative Gardner? Okay. Who made the motion? Oh, Representative Lilly, is that okay with who you made the motion? Okay. Is there any other discussion on this before we vote? Okay. All in favor of the Representative Lilly's motion to pass this without recommendation, it would be re-referred to the Commerce Committee. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Representative Dabney, I see you someplace.
Good evening, Chair.
I
wasn't able to hear, sir. Which bill would you wish to do first?
Representative Dabney, why don't we take the one that came from your committee, the 3517.
All right.
Representative Saylor moves 3517 for Representative Dabney. Go ahead.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Chair and members, 3517 offers two options or two solves two problems for tenants. An emerging problem that has been seen in the foreclosure crisis in the state is that some lenders, particularly the larger lenders, have a policy or practice of automatically evicting a tenant when the lender takes possession of the foreclosed property, even if the tenant is current on their rent. That then leaves the tenant with a foreclosure, an unlawful detainer, on their rental record. The very fact of that unlawful detainer on their record then is an impediment to them being able to move forward, recover from the loss of their housing, and secure new housing. 3517 then provides a court process for mandatory expungement of the eviction from their record if the situation is one where they were current on the rent but were evicted because of the policy or practice of the lender of the landlord. Secondly, particularly for low-income renters, the loss of both housing and the money involved in damage deposit last placement can provide a real barrier to them securing their next housing option. This is forcing some into needing to go back to counties for emergency assistance, but counties are only allowed to provide people emergency assistance once each 12 months. So if someone is really in an unlucky situation and they are being evicted within a 12-month period after receiving emergency assistance, they do not have that funding available to them. So this allows them to retain their last month's rent. The landlord gets to use the damage deposit in lieu of that money, and they can then have something to take forward to help secure new housing.
Are there any questions on this? Okay. Representative Holder. Mr. Elwood, I believe, is...
I'd like to turn that question over to Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Elwood?
Mr. Chair and Representative Holberg, this is a first-class mail notice that is required under statute.
Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Chair and Representative Holberg, no, it's first-class mail. It's not return received certified.
Representative Holberg.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Chair and Representative Holberg, first of all, in order to avail oneself of this right, one needs to set forth an affidavit. So it's a sworn affidavit in a court of law. The party who is alleged to not have given the notice will receive notice of the hearing, and that party can come and contest that the notice in fact was given. So the statutory notice that's currently under 504B 285, which has been in current law, we're not creating a new notice. I mean, it's the same process been in place forever. So it appears that the protections are already in place to ensure that that this is utilized. And the idea here, remember, is that tenants who are victims in a foreclosure, who by no fault of their own are forced to leave, and there's a fairly routine situation where lenders just file the eviction notices, even if the tenants have already left or they didn't even know they were supposed to leave. So this is really an extraordinary remedy, and we don't expect this to happen all that much, but it certainly has happened enough so that we feel this is necessary at this point.
Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Chair and Representative Holberg, there's a typically if you in a court situation, if you have a routine procedure to mail notices and you demonstrate that, there is a presumption that notice was received.
Representative Holberg, is there any other questions or discussion on this? Okay, all in favor of what? Representative Saylor's motion to pass with recommendation and refer it to Commerce, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Representative Dabney, your mixed bill. Representative Paymar moves House File 3516, I believe. 3517?
Did we just do 16?
No.
We just did 17.
We did 17. 3516.
3516, Mr. Chair.
That's what I thought. Okay. That's what I had announced, and I was informed by the expert I was wrong. But
and, Mr. Chair, you should find in H3516A1 amendment.
Representative Dabley, have a little problem. The expertise was wrong. We have to reconsider the last motion and refer it directly to the general register. So, first we have to reconsider. So, all in favor of reconsidering the motion to send it to the Commerce Committee, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. I assume there's no discussion on the motion now is to pass the last one with recommendation to the general register. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries.
Thank you.
Now, Representative Paymar moves House File 3516.
And, Mr. Chair, again, you should have an members should have an H3516A1 amendment in their packets.
Representative Paymar moves House or the A1 amendment to get it in the shape the author wants. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For members who are interested, that was a largely technical amendment with one exception, and that is on page 2, line 34. It deletes the sunset date for the body of the bill before you. That does align it with the Senate file that was heard previously. Members, there's two issues being dealt with in this legislation as well. First, better and more elaborated information for the owner or occupant of the property when they at various points through the foreclosure process when they receive notice. For instance, currently, if you are served a foreclosure notice at the beginning of the process, that notice does not include the commonly understood street address of the property, but instead the legal description. And while experts in the field will tell you that the street address is a bit soft and squishy from a technical point of view, most of us wouldn't recognize the legal description of the properties we own. We would recognize our own address. And this simply works to provide occupants clearer notice so they're better informed during the foreclosure process. You'll note on page 2, lines 5 through 8, do provide some comfort language that was requested by members of the real estate bar to assure that inadvertent lack of this information did not result in court action that would suspend the foreclosure process and maintain the balance of relationship between the borrower and the lender. And lastly, the Secretary of State's office has graciously offered to convene a working group to look at creating a report and a study regarding the development and implementation of a statewide foreclosure data collection and reporting system. With me tonight is Professor Jeff Crump from the University of Minnesota's Housing Studies Department.
Thank you, Mr. Crump.
Mr. Chair.
Seen a lot of you this year.
Yes. Thank you. Well, as Representative Dabney pointed out, the bill really has two parts. One part is to provide more complete, basically locational information on various already existing public foreclosure documents. And the second is to create a study group hosted by the Secretary of State to look into the development and implementation of statewide electronic data collection for foreclosure information. Currently, there are only two counties in the state of Minnesota that make foreclosure information available in electronic form. This greatly hinders the tracking of where simply figuring out where foreclosures are occurring in our state. In 2002, I collected data on Hennepin County by hand from the paper files, and that cost approximately $25,000 in labor costs to do that and just simply map the foreclosure data. And also, there is other moves to move certain documents to electronic form, for example, the electronic certificate of real estate value. And I think this is in line with improving the availability of information.
I just want to state that we're very fortunate. I talked to the Secretary of State, and after many conferences, he finally agreed to do this study without any money directed to him, which is very good in this year of budget problems and not very usual for any department to do. But so we have to thank the Secretary of State for doing this study. Representative Downey.
If I may say, Mr. Chair, we also need to thank Professor Crump for his leadership of the data collection working group. His expertise as a geographer and particularly use of locational information and understanding of some of the systems that are already in place was very helpful in guiding the committee to the creation of this legislation.
Yes, and Representative Downey, Mr. Crump has also done an awful lot of studies on this from the HUD data and different things on foreclosure. Representative Holbrook.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Downey, I don't have any qualms with your bill other than I'm curious why the group that's in charge of data practices for the state isn't included in your study. Do you think that there's a change in policy analysis that I've had? I'm not sure why the Secretary of State would be doing that.
Representative Downey.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, you make good points. I should have been able to anticipate from you. If you would want to add that, offer that as a friendly amendment at this time, I would certainly be willing to accept it. I think you make a valid argument that while staff has looked at this and not seen a data practices aspect to this at this time, the path may take people places, and I was certainly concerned about striking the appropriate balance between access to data so that we can make good public policy and protecting the privacy of homeowners and investors. So, again, if you wanted to make a friendly amendment, I would certainly be open to that.
And Mr. Chair, I think
Representative Holbrook.
I'll just do one for the floor, and then I will put our names on it.
Totally accepted by me, Mr. Chair.
Is there any other discussion? Who made the motion? Representative Downey, I have no idea, and we can't figure out why this one was requested by Commerce either. It's got nothing to do with that committee unless it's because you're including the Department of Commerce on the list of people or groups. But if it has to go to every committee that has one of these groups, you're going to get done by December. Maybe in time for the next one.
Which year?
But for whatever reason, the Commerce has requested it. So Representative Paymer renews his motion to pass as amended with recommendation, and that it be referred to the Commerce Department. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lilly. Chair Mullery, the powerful Vice Chair of Commerce and Labor, Representative Leon Lilly,
Do you share your home address posted, sir? I see he's withdrawing his request to see your bill.
So that he gets bills heard again.
Chair Mulry, House File 3475. I assume you'd like to move the bill to have it before the committee. And you have a DE1 amendment.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would move the DE1 amendment.
Chair Mulry moves the DE1 amendment to get the bill in the shape he would like it. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Anyone opposed, say nay. The motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. The bill's in the shape you would like it. Proceed, Chair Mulry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. And what I'll do is hit the main points. This is a fairly lengthy with a lot of technical points in it. The first part is regarding tax statements, and it just changes some names on it. The second is affects attorneys' liens, so all of the attorneys in here and the ones who are studying to become attorneys are affected by that, but it just says that this conforms to the fact that you can't have the old attorney's lien on a homestead without the particular waiver. The third one specifies a requirement in the sheriff's sale regarding service on a judgment debtor. The fourth one is the certificate of the sale of realty, which is another technical one. The fifth is also a technical on redemption. Now, under 6 and 7, we start to get into the real point of this bill, the important parts, which are what this bill does is it requires that a mortgage company, when they send out I think it's the 4720 notice, I believe is the exact statute number, they have to also send out to an agency a notice for counseling, and then the counseling agency can then directly contact the occupant, and the DE1 amendment takes into account the fact that they can do that without having to get an opt-out, which had come originally from the committee. The notice of sale is in number 9. 10 is more technical parts to the foreclosure notice. Number 11 is important. It's of specific additions to the foreclosure notice that's sent to the tenant. Number 12 is to modify the existing law to provide that a sale must be between the hours of 9 and 4. I think at present it's something like sunset, or it's unlimited, or the sheriffs anyhow were very insistent that we were correcting other things, that we correct this so that they have only office hours that are applied there. Number 13 affects the publication, and it saves a lot of money for the postponement of the sale. It used to have to be published every week during the postponement. Ran up huge charges. 14 changes the contents in the certificate of sale. The 15 provides that to redeem lands during the 6-month redemption period, the mortgagor must pay the amount for which the land was sold plus interest at the rate stated in the certificate of sale, and if there's no rate, at the rate of 6%. 16 is redemption by a creditor, and technical on that. 17 is another redemption technical amendment. 18 adds the current law providing for actions to set aside a mortgage or foreclosure to allow a dispute of the priority of liens to be included. And, of course, that's something that should have always been in there. 19 is regarding reinstatements. And 20 affects redemption and sets a particular interest rate that's payable during the redemption period. It used to be fluctuating so much that the sheriff couldn't even figure out what it was. In 21, the purchaser can pay the taxes and other expenses. And it also affects the affidavit of allowable costs and the way the calculation of redemption amount is done. It also affects and sets some limit on the costs that can be added in. And 22 allows a limited right of entry. And that's it, basically, for the provisions. It's again, this one is one that was agreed to by everybody that I can think of. This was the major one coming out of the remedies group, and everybody agreed to all of these terms. If we have questions, Daryl Dannon, who was the coordinator for this group, is here. And also Kevin Dunleavy to discuss if somebody wants to get in the technical legalities of the foreclosure process. But that's all this is.
Thank you, Chair Mullery. Questions from members? Representative Simon. Chair Mullery. Representative Simons.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering where this is.
That was
Chair Mullery.
Mr. Chair and Representative Simons, that was agreed to by the various parties. It was decided that we had to have a specific rate in here, and they were having a lot of problems with fluctuating rates. But if you want to. Ms. Dannon or Mr. Dunleavy can come up and tell you why they said 6%, but since it was agreed by all parties, I thought that it was probably appropriate.
Thank you, Chair Mullery. Other questions from members? Seeing none, Chair Mullery renews his motion that House File 3475 as amended, be recommended to pass, and this again, this also is on the train to the Commerce Committee, I understand.
And Mr. Chair, again, this is straight real estate law, belongs going to the floor, but we'll send it to the Commerce Committee.
I believe that hopefully we have a friendly year in the Vice Chair when it gets to that committee. The powerful Vice Chair again, excuse me.
Mr. Chair, we would hope that the Vice Chair of the Commerce Committee has a discussion with the committee. Administrator, whoever it is that's requesting these bills, that don't go there.
At least it will have its friends with it for company when it gets there. So, motion is renewed to pass as amended and refer to the Commerce Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. The bill is passed and.
Thank you. Representative Clark's bill was laid over, but we have some people, I guess, that I think it's Sherry Pugh, and I'm not sure who else. There was one other person, I believe. I'm told that NPR has been announcing all day that this was at North High, so there is a slight problem there. Ms. Pugh, do you want to? We'll reopen for a very short period the testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Sherry Q. Sullivan. I'm the Executive Director of the Northside Residents Redevelopment Council. And I just wanted to give some overviews. First, I want to thank the legislature for really addressing the issues of foreclosure. But for our community, it's a little bit more than just foreclosures. We've seen this heading our way for many years. To give you some background, Northside Residents Redevelopment Council is the oldest resident council in the city of Minneapolis. We are now 37 years old. We were the first organization in this state to start doing mortgage foreclosure counseling in 1989. We were the demonstration, which now has become a statewide network of mortgage foreclosure prevention counselors. In our neighborhoods in North Minneapolis, we have been providing this service, obviously, for over 15 years. And during that time, we've seen the trends that have come through the community. In the early days in this state, most of the loans were FHA. Matter of fact, Minnesota was considered the number one FHA loan state in the country. Only sometimes would Colorado beat Minnesota in terms of the number of FHA loans. Those were the days when people had mortgages and they had mortgage insurance. But what we saw as we increased home ownership in our neighborhood, which in 1960 was less than 25%, and from that point, moving into the 90s, we worked diligently in rehabbing homes, building infill houses, and got the home ownership rate in one of our neighborhoods up to 60%, which is higher than the city average, and another neighborhood, 35%. We have lost all of that with the foreclosures in the last 3 years. What we saw was in the late 90s, the onslaught of flipping mortgages. Our neighborhoods got hit hard. We seemed to be the target for whatever they called inappropriate mortgage products. We identified flipping, and once again, the city and the state responded and addressed that issue. But we were just getting out of flipping when all the new boutique models of mortgage lending products came out, and we became the testing ground once again for all these inappropriate models. Suddenly, as I said, we went from people who had insured mortgages to families who had 100% mortgage with a second, the second making up that 20%. And because they were told that insurance was a bad thing, they didn't get mortgage insurance. So if you can imagine, we went from a market that had insured mortgages to now we have very few. It's less than 20% of the mortgages in our community are insured. The reason I want to talk to you about this is that while you're addressing the response to foreclosure, we have another issue now. We're still peaking on foreclosures, but the erosion of our community base is really significant. It's not just significant, it is devastating. If you can imagine the grandchild whose family bought a home when she was a baby, who's now maybe in third or fourth grade, comes home and mom and dad say, we're moving. And suddenly they're moving, they're doubling up, and often they're in a homeless shelter because they've lost their home for foreclosure. That we've lost good residents. We've had residents who've been in our community for 15 years in homes. But because of trickery and misleading representation by lenders and contractors, appraisers, and others in the industry, people were put into products that made them lose their home. What happens to the elderly couple who's owned their home for 18 years? The wife is suffering from cancer. They operate a small home child care center in their home, and they need to get a home improvement because they've gotten some tags from the city inspection. The contractor gets them into a loan product, states their income at $8,000 a month, which is way above what their income is on the retirement, and they lose that home. So these are the stories of people in our community. Today you talked about renters, which is the other hidden factor that we're seeing. Renters in our community work hard to scrape their money together to pay rent monthly, only to find out one day that there's a foreclosure tag on their door. And they come to our offices and other neighborhood councils and say, what does this mean? I've been paying my rent. And suddenly they too are homeless. We called People Serving People just to ask them, you know, do you keep a count? Do you know how many people you're getting from the north side in your shelter? They said, you know, we don't keep data because we want to keep privacy. But they said, but we can tell you from the stories in that oral interview that these individuals are coming from your community, that they are renters who've been misled. I want to put to you, though, that in your work this year, you're working on the response to foreclosures. But We have a bigger issue, and it's an issue that goes beyond you. Obviously, the city needs to respond. The state needs to respond. But there needs to be a real push on federal reform, because I think that it's only at that level, but only with state legislators pressing our federal legislators to address a whole redesign of the mortgage industry. We have people who are damaged now in our community. They're not the ones who have $600,000 homes who 2 years from now can buy another home. They're people who are losing their homes and will never be able to achieve that Minnesota dream, home ownership. You know, in the UN, they talk about housing is a human right. And I think in Minnesota, for many years, we've thought that home ownership was a Minnesota thing. But we've lost that. We've lost not only the home ownership, but we've lost the building of our communities. We have families who are being shamed and losing their community connections and identity. We have children who don't understand what's happened to their family. We know that part of the response is at the federal level, but we also know that we need your support in helping support the community-based level. Don't forget, as you will do your work this session, that the response at the local base level is the most effective. That when people do get past the shame and guilt and embarrassment they have, they come to their neighborhood councils, they come to their local neighborhood service organizations. In rural communities, they probably go to their church or someone close in their town where they feel that they can be received with trust. And that part of the delivery service is most important in succeeding and trying to rebuild our communities. I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you, Ms. Pugh. The last one on the list is Catherine Doerr.
Yes.
Ms. Doerr, state your name. And
for the record, my name is Catherine Doerr, spelled with a C. And I have worked in the real estate business since approximately 1979. I am a licensed abstractor. I am licensed by the state of Minnesota to search courthouse records and prepare title reports. And I started with what's now called Old Republic. It was then known as Minnesota Title. Then I went to work for North Star Title, which is now Fiserv Financial Services. I wanted to thank the legislators tonight for coming out to the community and spending your time and your hearts to listen to what is being said. I would like to point out a couple things, at least from my perspective. There has also been an impact in the business that I am in. In a month period, traditionally, before all this mortgage crisis has happened, we have two law firms that are our customers. We do only foreclosure file searches for them. We did approximately five to eight per month. We now do 15 a week. They come in bunches rather than one or two at a time. Every time I see these, I just shudder because I know someone is losing their house, but this is my job. We've also seen cuts in our own business and in our office. I just finished taking 2 weeks of unpaid leave. We are now told we have a wage freeze for the next 2 years. I just lost my sabbatical for the second time because of this wage freeze. We've closed two of our major offices, one in Laguna Hills, California, and Rocky Hill, New Jersey. We also practically eliminated our headquarters in Pittsburgh. My neighbor next door was an independent closer and then went to work for Wells Fargo. He's been out of work since last November. So there are ramifications not only in the neighborhoods here with the homeowners, but in the industry as a whole. Secondly, I'd like to address another aspect of this that doesn't often get discussed, and this is the impact on the multiple housing type of properties that are in the city. I live in a 60-unit condo. I have an investment property in a 50-unit condo. So when one of these properties is in foreclosure and becomes vacant, and I speak as a former board officer that served multiple positions and terms on both boards of condominiums, this impacts the financial viability of those homeowner associations because they are not receiving the assessment fees, on a regular basis from that homeowner, and sometimes it takes months for the mortgage company to start kicking in. And so you don't have one house that's sitting there boarded up like you drive down the blocks here. This affects the viability of a multiple 2-3 block area of 50 or 60 units. And it is very difficult for these nonprofit associations to recover that loss in their income and that hole in their budgets. And lastly, I know much of the testimony tonight has been on homeowners that are in foreclosure and what you can do to relieve those situations and help those people. But I would urge you to also consider some proactive things so that we don't repeat this terrible scenario again in 10 or 20 years. I passed out a handout today that I printed off the Vanguard website that I get, and I would ask that there be some consideration or future legislation and discussion on the appropriateness of the mortgages to the homeowners. Not only financial education of homeowners, but we have the same thing with investments, where you don't have senior citizens taking out these egregious annuities that are a very costly item. Something similar with a mortgage business as well, so you don't have homeowners taking out inappropriate mortgages that they cannot possibly qualify for. And just in brief, I would mention that if you have a chance to read the Vanguard article, that is addressing the appraisal problem. That's another piece of this whole puzzle. And this is an effort based on lawsuits coming out of the Attorney General's office, Andrew Cuomo out of New York, that will have the independent appraisers with consumer protections. Those people, the appraisals, have been hand in glove with the mortgage companies. Cuomo's lawsuits were attempting to remedy that situation and create more independence between those entities. Thank you again for your time and your ear to listen.
Oh, Representative Simon?
Yeah. If I may, Mr. Chair, I'd like to ask a question of either Ms. Pugh or Ms. Gore. I'm wondering, what are the two of you think about this idea being kicked around at a federal level of a foreclosure moratorium or something like? Do you think that makes sense? Is it workable? Is it unworkable?
Representative Simon, I think you should pick one of them. Okay.
I think that a moratorium gives someone in foreclosure time to breathe. I'm not sure that in 30 days that people understand what they have to do in 30 days. So if you give them a 30-day moratorium, what no one's saying is you've got to work every day. You've got to work 30 days every day, calling your bank, calling someone to work that. And so the stress is so great that the 30 days is like, it's like an aha moment. It's like, okay, breathe. And then you get to day 29, and there's not enough time to resolve it. So I don't think that the moratorium really does it. I think the lenders have to own up to what they've done. And, you know, the SNLs had to, 20 years ago? And I just think that that's where the resolution
represents.
And a related question. There is some talk in the airway of some people who say, look, this is just all about borrowers who got in over their heads, and they are, if not to blame, then at least they don't deserve any sort of, they deserve very little sort of government interference. What's your response to that?
Ms. Pugh?
Is your experience that people are to blame for?
Well, first of all, the history always has been that the bulk of the foreclosures were people who had either unemployment or a health incident. That's where the majority of foreclosures have always been. Now that has trended differently, but I think that yes, people may have been too trusting. There was a targeting on this. I can tell you from the African American community, if you walk down the street and you ask a bunch of African Americans down the street, why don't you buy a home? Probably 50% of them would say, well, I don't have good credit. I mean, unfortunately, we've taken on that stature. And so then you say, well, no, you can do it. You can do it. So then someone says, well, you can do it, and I'm going to really help you. And there's always, the people who did this were very skilled. It was like, take a 10% loan this year, and in 2 years you can clean up your credit. Well, the reality is it's not easy to clean up your credit in 2 years. But they're believing, they're hoping. So I think that there was targeting, and I think that the people who did the targeting knew what they were doing, and they picked victims. I mean, it is clear there's been, what, 100, they said between $150 to $200 billion of equity loss in African Americans nationally. You can't tell me that that's not targeted. The fact that at one point 70% of all the subprime loans in the state of Minnesota were in North Minneapolis, you can't tell me that that wasn't targeted. So I think that that the numbers show that there was deliberate targeting of communities and certain cultural groups.
Okay.
I was going to make a motion. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, for having us out here today and allowing us to hear these folks. At this point, I know we have session in about 45
right.
minutes, so unless somebody else has something urgent, I offer to make a motion to adjourn if that's
Thank you, Representative Inler. I want to thank everybody for coming out and listening to the community that's suffering the most in Minnesota. So thank you. Motion to adjourn. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries.
Thank you.